I think one of the most interesting ways of studying church history is by focusing our attention on the people. We think immediately of the role that was played by this Augustinian monk from Wittenberg, Martin Luther.
And you don't get more of a real person than Martin Luther.
To understand Luther, you have to understand this enormous burden of guilt that haunted him in the monastery. He would say, you ask me, do I love God? Love God. Sometimes I hate God.
And it wasn't until he realized the power of the gospel. The righteousness that God demands is not a righteousness that I produce, but that is alien to me. And that alien righteousness comes to me solely and exclusively because of what Christ has done.
The Legacy of Luther, edited by R.C. Sproul and Stephen J. Nichols. To obtain your copy, call 800-435-4343. Under the leadership of Puritan pastors like Richard Mather, New England was a strict place to live.
Better we should exclude 10 real Christians from the church than admit one non-Christian. And his idea was, we are so obligated by Christ to keep the church pure that we better be very, very careful about church membership.
In the 17th and 18th centuries, the Puritans began leaving Europe to establish new colonies in the Americas. Religious freedom was their aim. We'll see today, here on Renewing Your Mind, that they didn't quite reach their goal. We've been studying church history every Saturday here on the program. Dr. W. Robert Godfrey has been our guide, taking us from the early church in the book of Acts and now to the early years of American history. Dr. Godfrey is one of our teaching fellows here at Ligonier Ministries, also the chairman of our board, and a respected church historian. So let's join him now as he continues our series.
In our last lecture, I think I said that we were done with the Puritans. And of course, if you're an American, you're never done with the Puritans. So we're not really done with the Puritans, but we are done with the Puritans in England. And we're moving to New England. We're moving to the New World. And we want to talk about the foundations of religion in the American colonies. And that will be the foundation on which we'll begin to look more over the rest of these lectures and then in a future series on religion in America. The first thing I suppose we ought to try to be clear about is that although the Puritans came to the New World, they didn't come to the New World to do anything new. They came to the New World to bring the old world there, only they hoped perfected, or at least improved. The Puritans who came to New England, and we'll be focusing on New England, which means particularly the Massachusetts Bay Colony and later the Connecticut colonies, we're focusing on them because that's where the most intense and concentrated religious reflection took place in the colonies. There were other important colonies being founded. There were important religious events going on in the other colonies. But it's in New England that, in particular, there was an intense focus on the future, on the hope, on what they wanted this new world to become. And we need to recognize, in many ways, it was just the perfection or the improvement of what had been the Puritan ideal in the old world. The Puritans who came to New England, by and large, tended to have given up hope of great improvement in England. Or at least they thought more rapid improvement could take place in the New World, and that the New World, many of them believed, could have a real role in redemptive history. And so they used language of the prophets about an errand into the wilderness or a city set on a hill. They really believed that what they were going to do in the New World, as John Owen would put it, although he stayed in England, would hasten the coming of Christ. Almost all of the Puritans who came to the New World were believers that Christ would glorify his church. They were looking forward to a great day of success for the gospel and for the church. And they believed that the crucial preparation for those days of glory was for Christ Church and Christ's people to be as faithful as they could in living before Him, in believing in Him, in worshiping Him. And many of the Puritans who came to New England believed that New England was the place where that could really be done best. Some of them who came, those who came particularly to Plymouth in 1620, they came as what we call separating Puritans, or separating Congregationalists better. They were those who had given up on the Church of England. Some of them were willing to say the Church of England was a false church, and it was time to really have a pure church. And so they self-consciously separated themselves from the Church of England. They came to the New World to establish the true church, and those were the separating Congregationalists at Plymouth. But most who came, particularly those who would arrive in Cape Ann in 1623 and then really found the Massachusetts Bay Colony in Boston in 1629, those were non-separating Congregationalists. Now, this is a little confusing. They were more fully called non-separating, non-conforming Puritans. That is to say, they didn't say the Church of England was a false church. They didn't formally separate from the Church of England. But when they arrived in the New World, they did not conform to the practices of the Church of England. They didn't have a bishop and they didn't want a bishop. They didn't use the Book of Common Prayer and they didn't wear vestments of the Church of England. So although they were technically still part of the Church of England, they really were living a very Congregationalist church life, very different from the Church of England. And they thought that this faithfulness to the Lord, faithfulness in worship, faithfulness in doctrine, faithfulness in church government, these were the things that would prepare for the coming of the Lord. The Lord would honor their faithfulness by hastening the day of His return. Now, they were Calvinists. They knew in a certain sense you can't change God's timetable. But they thought this was all part of what God wanted of them, that faithfulness would pave the way for the greater strength and glory and success of the church. And so part of this congregational way that they wanted to establish in the New World was to have a state church. They were not the least interested, most of them, in religious toleration. Religious toleration was just tolerating error and sin. What is the point of that? And so they were committed to this notion that it was only the congregational way that should be tolerated. And so in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, as the colony grew, as they had to organize politically as well as ecclesiastically for voting in political elections, you had to be a church member. That was the critical qualification to be a voter. You had to be a member of the established congregational church. It's intriguing that in some parts of New England, the Congregational Church continued to be established down into the 1830s. So when someone tells you that America never had established churches, that's not true. The nation as a whole never had an established church, and the Constitution's First Amendment guaranteed that the Congress wouldn't establish a church for the nation. But no one who wrote the Constitution thought that that meant at the time that states couldn't have an established church. And indeed, two or three states did have an established church well after the founding of the Republic. So the vision of the Congregationalists was very much an old world vision. We want a state church. The difference is we want a pure state church. We want a state church that will really be faithful to the Lord, will really live out our devotion to the Lord. And initially, this seemed to work in a wonderful way, because initially, for the first 10 or 20 years, everyone who was here had or We're not actually in New England, are we? Everyone who had come to New England had come out of a religious fervor. New England wasn't the most welcoming place to be a farmer, or initially at least to be engaged in commerce. And so the major motivation for most people coming early on to New England in particular was religious devotion and the opportunity to practice religion as they believed that the Lord had called them to do that. And so there was this wonderful sense of a new beginning. The wonderful sense of really doing the Lord's will and having the freedom to do that. The wonderful sense that surely the Lord would bless this enterprise and there would be great success to what was happening. And as more and more people came, it seemed that their expectations were being realized, and they plunged into all sorts of activities. Amongst other things, very early on, founding a college, the first college in the New World, founded in 1638. So really only about 15 years after the colonists had arrived, they were building a college. Calvinists have always been school builders. And it's wonderful Ligonier is building a Reformation Bible College and an academy, because it's very much in that tradition of being school builders. The great point of founding this school, named after a young Puritan, a fine young man who had died young, and so they wanted to honor his memory. This college was called, what was it called? Harvard. A Calvinist college founded for the purpose of primarily training Calvinist ministers. That was often the key motivation in founding a college, that there would be an educated ministry. The Latin motto of Harvard in its founding was Veritas in Christo, truth in Christ. That was the motto of Harvard College. Today, their motto is just truth. I assume that's just an abbreviation, that they're still devoted to Christ there too. But anyway, if we were only postmillennialists, we could hope that. But in any case, they set about, you see, laying the foundations of what they thought would be a lasting and influential and important society. And they began to be involved in missions to American Indians. This too was a very important part of what they were about. We see again this, wherever there was opportunity to do missionary work for Protestants, they got engaged in it, and they were eager to try to be involved in missions. It's often been said that John Eliot, one of the early Puritans, was an apostle to the American Indians, and there was great success in certain Indian tribes early on. Success at evangelization seemed to grow and continue until the fundamental nature of the colony began to change. When the colony began to change from a primarily religious colony to an increasingly commercial colony, then the commercial interests were no longer interested in the evangelization of Indians to the same extent, because they wanted the land. They weren't interested in the souls of the Indians. They were interested in the Indians' land, and that meant getting the Indians off of it. And so the whole evangelistic enterprise in the long run was undermined by those commercial interests. But the Puritans have so often been misunderstood and unappreciated that we need to see how broad their vision was. They saw themselves as an important part of human history unfolding, but we also have to see them as hard workers in laying the foundations of a Christian society that was not to include just themselves, but was to include the native peoples that were here when they arrived. So this was the great experiment. This was the great errand into the wilderness. And the problem was, pretty soon, within 20, 30 years, they began to see there were problems. Life has problems. And the problem that began to develop amongst them was the younger generation doesn't seem quite as enthusiastic as the first generation. And soon, questions were beginning to be raised. How do we ensure that the next generation will be true believers? How can we ensure that the next generation will be as faithful parts of the church as the first generation has been? And this began to intensify a question that had already been important in the life of these New England Puritans. What do we require of someone to be a church member? What are the qualifications for church membership? Well, of course, the standard things, you have to know Christian doctrine. You have to say you believe Christian doctrine. You have to be living an outwardly Christian life. But do we need more? Do we need a testimony of the work of grace in the heart? And most Puritans thought it was appropriate that there should be some testimony of the work of grace in the heart. Now, the problem for historians is, while this discussion went on rather intensively, what exactly were they looking for? We're not exactly sure. In other words, if the elders called you in and said to you, all right, we want a testimony from you about the work of grace in your heart, what would they be asking for? And we have actually a handful of written testimonies that have survived, but we don't know how representative they are. The shortest one we have is kind of intriguing because it's a list of ministers that were listened to and how each minister convinced the hearer more thoroughly of his sinfulness. There's not a lot about grace in that testimony. There's not a lot about Christ in that testimony. It was more about the work of the law humiliating me and making me see my own sin. And so we're not quite sure what these testimonies were, but what we are fairly sure of is that it had, over several generations, the effect of discouraging young people from coming to talk to the elders because they weren't sure they had the right things to say about the work of grace in their hearts. In other words, if I asked you if you've memorized your catechism lesson, you know whether you've memorized it or not. If I ask you how you're living, you can talk to me about how you're living. Even if I ask you, do you believe what you've read in the Bible, you can answer that. But if I say, now describe to me the exact way God has worked in your heart to lead you to grace, you may be able to do that. Maybe you were rebellious and there was a dramatic change in your life and you came to faith, you can talk about that. But you see, the second, third generation, they're being raised in a very strict church environment. And they've all their lives been faithful in church, learned the truths of church, kept the Sabbath day holy. Although some of those young people on a Saturday night would walk out. Ministers were very concerned about the walking out that was going on. Young people were discouraged about how am I going to describe what's gone on in my life? And the ministers themselves disagreed about how serious, how pointed this inquiry should be for church membership. One of the founders of the colony, Richard Mather, maybe you know that name, Mather. It became a very distinguished family. Richard Mather was a minister, and then his son, Increase Mather, there's a great New England Puritan name, Increase Mather, was one of the most influential ministers of his generation. And then Increase's son, Cotton Mather, became one of the great chroniclers of the early 18th century in New England and a minister. But this Richard Mather at the beginning said, better we should exclude 10 real Christians from the church than admit one non-Christian. Now, that's a pretty strict standard, isn't it? And his idea was, we are so obligated by Christ to keep the church pure that we better be very, very careful about church membership. One of Richard Mather's close friends, also a minister in New England, was named John Cotton. And John Cotton's daughter would later marry Increase Mather, and that's how we get Cotton Mather. You want to take notes on this because it's so fascinating. But John Cotton disagreed vigorously with his friend, Richard Mather. And John Cotton said, better to let 10 non-Christians into the church than to keep one true Christian out. Well, you can see there's quite a different idea going on here. Now, they could get along pretty well because they were Congregationalists. What that meant was that each minister in his own church was in charge of this matter of how to inquire for church membership. But taken as a whole, as the 17th century wore on, there was more and more tension about church membership, about the state of the church, about what they would later begin to talk about, God's controversy with us. They began to talk about God must be upset with us, God must be disturbed with us. And how can we improve this situation? We need to appeal to the Lord to return in power among us to set things right. And so there began, growing in part out of their postmillennialism, to be this eager expectation that this grand experiment that had begun with such strength and nobility now needed to be renewed, needed to be reinvigorated. How could that happen? What needed to happen? And then in 1684, tragedy struck. In 1684, the king in England revoked the charter under which they had been operating as a colony. And what that meant was that now they were in a complete limbo as to what the king might require of them. The old charter had allowed them pretty much to pursue their own way. They could elect their own governor, they could have their own church, they could make their own requirements for who could vote for the governor. And now the king had taken away all those rights in revoking the charter, and they didn't know what he was going to do. And so they sent Increase Mather to England to plead for them. And they were in a bad way for several years. And then the news came. The king had imposed a new charter, and he would appoint the governor. There would still be a kind of regional parliament, but voting for the parliament would be a matter of property ownership, not of church membership. And the whole system seemed to be crumbling around about them. It was just about this time that one of the most famous and disreputable events took place in New England, the Salem witchcraft trials in 1692. And a great deal has been written about the witchcraft trials, the last great witchcraft trials in America. A sad event, although the Puritan ministers were by and large trying to keep the hysteria under control. There's been a lot of bad stuff written about the witchcraft trials. But I think what's really important is it shows the tension that this society was under as it was being forced in a direction it had never wanted. It was being interfered with. And there was all of this anxiety that bubbled up now in this conviction in the hearts of many common people that somehow that devil himself was attacking their society and possessing five women who were ultimately executed as witches. Here's a society in stress, you see, a society in difficulty because their great adventure seems to be undermined. Now, we've gone through all this very quickly, 100 years in 20 minutes. But I hope you get a little bit of a vision, both of the idealism and the determinism in New England devoted to this enterprise, but also the stresses it was under and how ultimately their effort to kind of perfect the old world in the new world was being challenged and being undermined. We'll have to leave it there for this lecture, and we'll come back to carry on with the American story next time.
You're listening to Renewing Your Mind, and our study of church history begins to strike closer to home, doesn't it? Each Saturday, we return to Dr. Robert Godfrey's sweeping series, A Survey of Church History. He's led us through the centuries from the days of the apostles and now to the Salem witch trials. I found it helpful to understand the roots of that historical event. This entire series has put so many historical events like the Salem Witch Trials into proper perspective. And we'd like to send the series to you. It's 73 lessons on 12 DVDs. Call us with your gift of any amount at 800-435-4343. You can also make your request and send your gift when you go online to renewingyourmind.org. This is a helpful resource for individual study, but it's also suited for the classroom or small groups. Each lesson is about 23 minutes in length, which gives you time for further teaching and discussion. Again, for your gift of any amount, we will send you the 12 DVD set. Our phone number again is 800-435-4343, or you can make a request at renewingyourmind.org. I hope you and your family are enjoying the programming available on RefNet. In addition to faithful teaching and preaching, you'll find dramatic audio theater for family entertainment and encouragement, plus audiobooks for the growing Christian. You can listen to RefNet for free anytime at refnet.fm or when you download the free RefNet app. In the 18th century, the Enlightenment set the stage for the modern secular age we know today. How did it affect the church? We'll find out next Saturday as Dr. Robert Godfrey continues his series, A Survey of Church History, here on Renewing Your Mind.